All right, Alan. The book is Alan Doyle, Where I Belong, Small Town to Great Big Sea. Yes, he put his picture on the front of it. And you knew he would, that Viking hair of his. In behind him is Petty Harbor, south shore of the Avalon Peninsula. I don't think most people know about the Avalon Peninsula. They don't know about the south shore, but now they're going to know about Petty Harbor. Did you write the book? Where did it start? You got all these pages here, Alan. Where did it start? Where did you start from? Did you work then backwards, or you start at the beginning and work front?
Well, the origin of the whole project kind of came to me. Like, Random House Canada came to me in the fall of 2012 and said, we've been reading the blog you were writing on the Great Big Sea site. We think you could write a book for us. And I said, oh, okay. And I said, I've been telling the stories about the crazy dudes that I grew up with in my young life that was in Petty Harbor. That's kind of odd compared to everyone else's young life who was around my age. And I just started writing those stories down. So I didn't start anywhere other than with people. Like, I wrote little episodes. Like, the first page I think I wrote was about breaking my mother's piano, because it's always been a tragic thing in my life.
It was a big deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
Piano was everything.
Well, we had a piano before we had a bat room. So, it was a big deal. And then I wrote about the few superhero kind of fishermen that were on the wharf. And then I wrote about, and then I after a little while, I started organizing in my mind that I would write I wouldn't divide my life in young life or whatever into stages. I would divide it into topics. And I would write, here's all the stuff about work. Here's all the stuff about music. Here's all the stuff about religion. Here's all the stuff about, Petty Harbor. Here's all the stuff about cutting out tongues. Here's a store or two, and there was a discovery every time, every topic, every category, I would discover something, either small or big. But it was a great fun that way.
Were the memories fresh?
Yep. Most of them, especially the cartoon superhero guys that I talk about, they've never left me, right? Because they're kind of, they're it's like I had the young fortune to hang around with these gods, who they seemed like to me, right? They were 10 years old working on the wharf with these big salty fisherman dudes, man, and they curse and swear and
like Frank?
Yeah. Like Frank and guys like who would injure themselves like Frank did regularly and, would rip the wires of a pacemaker from his chest. And, but they would tell, being 10 years old and they'd be cursing and swearing and you'd overhear them talking about, brothels they might have been in Spain when they were on a supply ship or something. It was just fantastic, right?
Anybody not from Petty Harbor was from away, right?
Yeah, for sure, yeah. And in different degrees, there was townies.
Well, your mom was from away.
My mom was from away, yeah. She was from, she wasn't belong to Petty Harbor. She's belonged to Marystown. And it's a funny nomenclature, and it's kind of why I named the book after that. Like, it's a funny thing to have that turn of phrase mean so much, like where I belong. And because I belong to Petty Harbor, and you can never only belong to one place. And you can never change where you belong to, and so, for example, my mother has lived in Petty Harbor all but 16 years of her life, but she's not belonged to Petty Harbor. She's belonged to Marystown. I have lived in St. John's since 1986, but I'm not belonged to St. John's. I'm belonged to Petty Harbor.
Do they agree with that?
Yeah. Everyone does in Newfoundland. Yeah.
How's the book work in Petty Harbor?
So far, so good.
Have you done a signing there?
Yes, I did the official launch of the book in the recreation building in Petty Harbor, which is actually repurposed at my old school. Oh. Where I went to school from grade kindergarten to grade 8 is now the dance hall in Petty Harbor, and where I played many gigs with my Uncle Ronnie's band and my father, and that's where we did the official launch of the book.
Did you read from the book?
Yeah.
Did you read about them?
Yeah.
Did they laugh at themselves?
Yes. And because, that's one of the joys of Petty Harbor is that I think everyone's been aware of how kind of frozen in time it's always been. And Petty Harbor people have always found themselves immensely entertaining, right? And it was one of the things about, I think it's true for a lot of small towns. You look inward before you look outward, right? And you think that, what's in your backyard is cool. And, the guy who drives the tractor from your town is the best tractor driver in all of the world, and that kind of thing. But it was odd to be doing a book launch in Petty Harbor. It could very well be the first one that was ever done about Petty Harbor in Petty Harbor and that kind of thing. So it's like, it was a special night.
See, you have no idea what effect you'll have on Petty Harbor down the way, because all of a sudden they realize that they are this thing. It's not just life on the streets or on the docks. People know them now. They know these stories. There's a way is all of a sudden part of the part of the town.
It's one of the great dangers, isn't it, of writing about something. If you study something too much and you realize it's being studied, it instantly changes. But I think, you know, as far as I was concerned, and still am concerned, the whole book was simply a love letter to my mom and dad and to the Doyles in Petty Harbor and to the people of Petty Harbor and to the childhood that I was given, you know, because it was because of all those people and all the really weird and crazy experiences, specific experiences in a specific place that led, when the job came up for grabs, the best gig in Newfoundland history came up for grabs, as total luck would have it, I was a good guy for the gig. I probably wasn't the only guy for the gig, but I was prepped for that job, man, when it showed up, you know, like, and I have only my folks and Petty Harbor and to thank for that, really.
How are they doing?
Great. Oh, they're excellent. We did a gig last weekend again. Mom and Dad, we still play. We still do gigs, and they're great. You know, I think they're chuffed that our family's story is told, you know, at least in through my lens anyway. And I think, you know, I think any family would like to have that.
And Bernie?
Oh, all good, yeah. They're good. My older sister, Kim, is... You know, she was one of the ones I went to first with the book because she was, you know, she's like a very prominent woman in St. John's right now, very, you know, and I had a bunch of stories in here about, you know, her and poop, you know, and then my brother Bernie, I wasn't so worried about because, you know, most of the shenanigans we got up to, he was right there with me the whole time. And any story I've told in a pub about it, he's told just as loud as I have. And then and my little sister, Michelle, of course, she doesn't feature so big in this part of the book. Because she was barely just a little infant. You know, she's 7 or 8 years younger than me. So
you saw yourself as a ladies' man.
No, I saw myself as a fellow who tried his best and failed miserably more often than not.
That's funny. If you want a laugh, just go to those parts of the book. Yeah. It's called Where I Belong, Alan Doyle. If you're from Petty Harbor, you're from up the harbor, or you're from down the harbor.
That's right.
The bridge divides the Protestants from the Catholics.
Yeah.
It divides the schools. Mm. It divides the stores. Mm. That's a big deal in a small town.
It is.
That you're divided like that.
Yeah, it was a big deal to me, even though, like, by the time my generation came around, like, by the time I was, say, 10, you know, in 1979, any kind of honest-to-God social divide was gone. I mean, people dated each other and that kind of stuff for real. It was noted by the older generation and stuff. But... like, the big difference was, look, we were still divided by schools. Like, the Catholics and Protestants didn't go to the school together, you know, because there were still denominational schools in Newfoundland. And for me, when I was a kid, the first thing I ever remember noticing was how religion had affected the footprint of the town. It was like, this doesn't make any sense. What, like, there's 400... why do we have two stores? We could have one good store. Like, why don't we...
But you were openly dating Protestant girls.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, as much as we could. But they were far away. It was hard to get at them because they went to school in town, see?
Yeah.
So it was. We fantasized for many, many months and years about how finally getting out with a Protestant girl would be instantly rewarding, you know, because, you know, if I was to believe, you know, the rumors I had heard that, you know, they were all on the pill and easy. Imagine my disappointment to find out, you know, it was just as hard to lay your cards over there.
And they could see you coming.
Oh, no question about
it. All your Petty Harbor moves.
All my Catholic boy moves.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's talk about Bernie for a second, because God bless him. Bernie was the guy that sat you down in the bedroom and played DJ and talked about, not just didn't play the tunes and Billy Joel and all that stuff, but actually talked about it, made you aware.
Yeah, Bernie was the first guy, and still is to this day, a better musical mind than me, but he's the first guy that I ever saw kind of dissect music, not just enjoy it, but try to figure out, you know, the way all of us guys now who produce music for a living or whatever, like, he was the first guy I ever saw do that. He was just like, he would notice if there was more than one singer singing at the same time, or if you could go, he could notice, like, in the chorus, see that? It goes from one of his voice to two of his voices. They're singing the same thing, but that's what makes it sound bigger.
Song structure.
Yeah, and he would go, his voice is doubled in the chorus, or he would go like, that's more than one, I'd be trying to figure out how to play a Stone song, for example, on guitar, and it was hard, I couldn't do it, and he goes like, that's because it's two guitars. He goes, that's not one guitar, listen, if I pan it over here, that's one thing, yeah. That's two different guys, that's two parts. He said, you can't play both those parts, you know, or he would like figure out stuff like, he was the first guy that I knew, he'd go, that's tune different. That guitar is not—it's not tuned the same. And he didn't play guitar even, like. But he goes like, just listen. It doesn't sound like he had an ear, and still has an ear for kind of composition that I envy. You know, like I guess maybe it's an engineering thing or something. He thinks of it in a clinical way.
Thank God he told you.
I know. Yeah, I was grateful. I still am. And even him and another friend of mine named Greg Hocko, who's Alan Hocko's. Famous Alan, Republic of Doyle Alan's older brother. He was my first early musical confidant who was my age. And I was going in the 80s when I was listening to Whitesnake and Def Leppard. You know, he was like, and Bon Jovi, you know, he would go like, yeah, that's cool, but I think you should probably listen to Queen. And I was like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, go listen to Queen. The show is just as good. There's just as much stuff going on. The music's way better. It's way more thoughtful stuff. And
it
I go,
was.
Oh. And I, you know, he was 12, you know, like, and how lucky I was to have, like, that was only two of a few guys, but to have those guys in your young life, right, going like, yeah, you can do better than that, man.
I'm glad you cleared up Boy on Bridge. I never bothered to ask you about Boy on Bridge. Sometimes I just avoid titles, because it's a title, But that was your credit in Whale for Killing.
Yeah.
Boy on Bridge.
I didn't know about it till. About 6 or 7 years ago, somebody said you should go look at your IMDb page, your Internet Movie Database, right, page. And I was like, what's that? It's like, it's all your credits from TV and stuff and blah, 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 you know? And I was like, oh. And he said, there's a credit there from you from like 1979 or 78. And I was like, what? He said, go look at it. So I went and looked at it. And, you know, all the stuff, Great Big Sea on Rita McNeil's
Further
show.
Cast,
and
more cast.
Blah, blah, blah. And then the very first one, I mean, I was like, Alan Doyle, Boy on Bridge, Whale for the Killing. And I was like, wow. Because, you know, when I think about me as a kid, and I think about if there's a physical picture of my own kind of wanderlust and curiosity, and I picture a boy on the bridge. I sat on that bridge, man, so often, like hitchhiking to the Ghouls to go to school, or hitchhiking to St. John's to go to work, or hitchhiking to gigs, or just waiting for the bus, or trying to figure out if I go over to the Protestant side or stay on the Catholic side. Or it was a place where I physically spent a lot of time, but also like in my mind, like, you know, the whole notion of the bridge, like to somewhere, like, you know, like that's where I wondered the most. Cause I, you know, all we had was wonder, right? I couldn't go to the library and look up what people were doing in California. I didn't have the internet. We didn't have cable television.
But you wondered more than most, right?
Probably. Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah.
I can't do the voice, but whenever in the book Where I Belong, when they talk about the Doyles, when they talk about the Doyles, oh, geez, the Doyles, they're singers. They all play and sing, eh?
Yeah.
That was your reputation.
Yeah, you're Dolphin Petty Harbor, so what do you play? You know, the Doyles for generations were the singers and they occupied a weird place in Petty Harbor. They still do because none of them are fishermen. The Doyles for like generations have not been fishermen in a town of only fishermen. My grandfather and his brother were the first managers of a hydroelectric plant, a little small hydroelectric plant in Petty Harbor. And a lot of my uncles all work for Newfoundland Light and Power or stuff, but none of them were fishermen. My father was a nursing assistant and the like, and geez, man, it's like, and on top of that, there were the musos, right? They were the musicians. They were the jesters and the entertainers. So when it came time to someone to be in the church choir, that was the Doyles, and then if it was someone playing for the dance, well, that's the thing, and then the St. Patrick's Day concert will be the Doyles, and Uncle Ronnie will lead the thing, and then the band for the dances and for the clubs and the dance halls was always my Uncle Ronnie's band, you know, and I started playing in that band when I was 13.
And got paid. Yeah. Well, not initially, but then eventually.
I think I was 14 the first time I got paid to play a gig in a club. And I went down to Southern Shore at my Uncle Ronnie's band and filled in for my Uncle Leonard on a Sunday afternoon matinee. And I started getting paid to play music then. And it's just like it's always been such a great lesson with that band was always because they played for fishermen's dances, you know, and stuff. And so they'd go and the first set of music would be jigs and reels,
yeah,
accordions and blah, 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 you know, and then dance stuff. And then the second set would probably be 1950s music. Oh, Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly and, you know, and you know, the Twists and stuff like that. The third set most likely is be country and western, you know, and then the fourth set would be rock and roll.
And why would you go outside between sets?
I would have to go out because I was too young to be in there.
But they came and got you.
Yeah. In truth, that would only happen probably the first or second time I was in the club, and then you just know everybody. And then by the time I was 16, I was so known in all those clubs, like, yeah, that's just Alan. He's in the band, whatever.
Why did your mom tell you always to run up and down the hill?
Because.
What was she saying?
Go do something.
Yeah.
And
or don't ask that question because I don't have the answer?
I think it was more like, go occupy yourself with something that's going to be good for you. You know, and go run up and down the hill was just because we lived on a hill. It was like, I think, you know what, now that you mention it, and I'd probably never thought about this till just this very second. I think she probably, man, it was simpler than all that. She just wanted me to beat myself out so I'd shut up and go to bed out of it. You know, she was probably tired of listening to me.
You talk about, in quotation marks, special attention, or I put the quotation marks on. Yes, you could make a living as a musician. Yes, you could move beyond Petty Harbor. But there was that, as you get Narnia, that special attention where you could have the command of the room, which is, as you know, is a very addictive.
When
the spotlight hits you, do you remember those moments?
That's the drug of choice, man. It's like, you know, the two things about I noticed at a very young age about music and about being a singer especially was that, as you say, you get that instant gratification of what you're doing and people appreciate it instantly. And I have lots of friends who are actors, you have lots of friends as well, who like, you know, they don't get that right away, man. You do a movie, it comes out 11 months later and people maybe like it and you're not there when they clap, if they clap at all. And like the immediacy you get for singing a song, the immediate response you get to that, whether it's good, bad, and different, whatever, it really is, like as you say, like addictive and a drug. But the other, I mean, in a very practical sense, and I talked about it in the book about the special attention, and I mean it in a very practical way. My uncles and, you know, the musicians in Petty Harbor, and ever since, and it continues to this day, you get away with shit that most people don't get away with because you're in the band.
Cut slack.
Yeah, you're caught slack because, and I always like, you know, if somebody now was like, you know, well, what do you think about it? So, you know, when I was young, I'd be like, oh, do you see Johnny Fisherman down the road got drunk last night now, ran the truck through the fence. Now, what is wrong with him? Blah, 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 blah. And then if, did you see what Uncle such and such did? Got drunk after the concert and drove the fence. I'm like, what a car it is. Yeah. We'll be over. We got to go over and he's the best. We got to go over.
Let's take him some bandages.
It's just like, I saw it so often. Like there were, the leash they had was so much longer than everybody else's. And I was just like, well, I want that. I want that gig.
Alan Doyle, Where I Belong is the name of the book, A Small Town to Great Big Sea. Now, and it's apparently, well, we're going to talk about this for a second, not the end of his writing, apparently. Page 210.
Yeah.
I told you a couple of minutes ago. It was about religion, because, yeah, you know, you were working in the church, you were an altar boy. It was the Catholics and the Protestants. It was, you all of a sudden found yourself in a religious-free, agnostic zone. How long did it take to get there, and what was that moment like?
Oh, it took a while to finally, like, I think in my late teens or my early 20s, to go like, I don't think I'm actually Catholic. I don't think I actually am that anymore. Like, or I think I'm kind of done with that. Like, I don't know if I want to, I don't go to mass. I don't go, you know, I don't actually think that the dude up on the, you know, up on the altar is any more of a dude than I am or anybody. Nor, and I don't think the dude in Rome is either. I'm pretty sure he's just a dude, you know, like you know, and probably a really learned dude and like a nice dude, I hope, you know, but like, he's just a dude, you know, he's just some fella. And I just, when I started studying world religions and stuff in university, and I learned that for every, you know, Christian guy or whatever, there's sure there's just as many Muslim guys or Sikh guys, or there's just as many, you know, Jewish guys or whatever, you know, it's just, and it, I became more and more aware, I suppose, and willing to let myself believe that I probably wasn't part of any religion. And it took a while to be okay with that. And then, you know, and then I talk about in the book about going into, well, maybe I'm an atheist. Maybe that's what I am. You know, and maybe, and I spent a long time reading, you know, Richard Dawkins books and the like, you know. And I, as much as I enjoyed the logic of it, I found it sort of discounted something that I find very special about, you know, humanness. And I said, I think, and I discovered this when I was writing the book, that I wondered, you know, if the one thing that we have that the other animals don't have is the ability to believe in something that we can't see, to believe in something that we don't know is true or not. And I don't necessarily mean a deity or something. I mean, like, faith, small f faith, fuels me every hour. I have to believe in stuff that seems impossible, or I don't do half the stuff I do. You know, like, I just, and I think there's a human quality that's important, and it's about believing in things that you don't know are there, and you don't know if you can make it to the top of the hill. You don't know if you can, but you pursue it with your heart, believing that at least you can, and there's a value in that, and that buys us so much, you know. So I don't know, I sort of went, I said, maybe I'm not atheist at all, maybe I'm something else, and I remain, I sort of left off the whole chapter. I was like, I don't know, I still have more questions than answers about all that.
But for some, most people, that's an internal dialogue. You're a songwriter.
Yeah.
You put it in song.
Yeah.
Something beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, that's kind of a very spiritual song I wrote for a friend who had just lost her husband to cancer. He was a buddy of mine. He was 30, you know, and I just, in a very practical way, I just wanted to express to her that, you know, there's, as bad as today is, there's something beautiful. Right now, you probably don't think there's a single beautiful day left to have, because that's the way it feels, right, when you get your, you know, you get your heart broken or whatever. But there is, and you know, there is going to be a beautiful day. You know, there will. It will be tomorrow or the next day or whatever, but there's still lots of good stuff left to do, you know. And I sort of think, you know, it's that, because we don't know what happens before or after we're here. We don't, you know. So I the only thing we know is that these days are precious. That's all we know. So, and I always say this, the worst day of your life is a day worth having. You know, like, there's no days that are not worth having.
How's today? Today's good.
Amazing. You get it?
Today's good.
Incredible.
This is the first of several books? Because, I mean, you wrote more than you needed.
Yeah, I wrote a whole bunch, and I just, I mean, I just became thrilled with the process of doing it. And as I was chatting to you about, it's writing books is actually a tremendous partner to being in a band.
Therapy.
It's, yeah, because you have one of the big shortfalls or whatever of pitfalls of being on the road all the time in a band is you have time to kill. And if you have, I would say, if you have time to kill, then time will kill you. And so you do, I found writing a book very, because it's time consuming. Right, and when you have time to consume, it's perfect. It's the perfect partner for a life on the road, or for like an actor in a trailer waiting to go on set.
So where will you pick it up?
I don't know the answer to that necessarily. It would be a very logical thing just to pick it up and keep going from where we left off. You know, when the band starts, that would make sense. It would also make sense to go back. I mean, I only explored my sort of young life, my Newfoundland experiences. In Petty Harbour, I didn't describe any of the ones I had in other towns since. You know, so if people were charmed by the Newfoundlandia of it, I would have lots to say about the crazy other people in other towns I met as well.
So while I was, Alan, while I was getting ready to do all this and read the book, loved the book, there's a new album coming out, January.
Yeah. New record called So Let's Go. It's a real combination of like my folk roots growing up in Petty Harbor with mandolins and whistles and accordions and piano accordion, like my mom played all the time. But I made it with the biggest kind of pop music makers of today in Canada. Like, I work with this guy named Tog Salter, who just finished all the Walk Off the Earth stuff. You know, they have these massive big pop songs that are, yet they're driven by ukuleles and eight people playing one guitar and stuff like that. And I was just charmed by that idea of making something small sound so big. And yeah, so I'm looking forward to people hearing it.
Were you writing the tunes the same time you were doing the book?
Yeah. Well, always, it's always, you know, I'm just happy to get a job, man. It's like, write a book, write a song, it's all good.
So I've heard five tracks.
Yeah.
Is the whole album, is there a theme to it?
There was
no liner notes, you know?
No. It's probably my most optimistic work I've ever done. It's very positive, and there's a few moments of kind of what I would call reflection on there about, you know, a little bit about being older than I was when I started playing music. But for the most part, it's optimism and about, you know, the stark realization that we only get so many summers, right? You only get so many Friday nights off in Vancouver. You know, seize the day, man.
There was a filmmaker and I said, why'd you do the script? He said, I realize I have maybe 6 or 8 scripts left in my life.
Yeah.
Because directors take forever to get the project done. And so he was looking at it in terms of the 5 years here, the 6 years here, the 7 years here, and then I'm done.
Yeah.
Do you think in those terms?
Yes. And you know what? I always did. I thought that way when I was 17. I swear to God, I wrote a little song when I was about 17 called You Only Get So Many Summers. And I think I should finish that song or rewrite or something. Because it's, you know, you only get so many, man. Like, and it's like, and it, when I think when you're young, especially, you just think that, you think that time is endless, right? And it's not, you know, and it's like, and to waste a day, man, holy shit, that's tragic. You know, like, tragic. Like, I'd rather go dig a hole than waste a day.
What if you had your knee opened up and you were on morphine? What about that? Is that a waste of a day?
I'd say you're a lucky bastard. That's what I would say. I hurt my back, and I was in the hospital a little bit laid up. And I understood narcotics for the first time, really. I was like, this, you know why people get addicted to drugs? Because drugs are fantastic.
That's why. Stool softener is also a very big high. Thank you. Hold on a second. There's a tour going with the album.
Yes. Tour goes with the album. The album drops January 20th. Tour starts January 21. Do a run in Southern Ontario, out east, in January. Come out west here in late February, early March. I think I'm here in Vancouver area, March 6, I think. And that goes down to the South U.S. and California and the like. And then there's a third run that starts in April that goes down the southeast, the northeast and southeast of the U.S., so New York, Philly, Boston.
You have two solo albums now, and you have the Library of the Great Big Sea. What do we want from you? What do you think the audience wants from you?
You know, I think two things. I think the audience wants a great night out every time they come see me.
Okay.
And that's not a responsibility I take lightly, you know, because that's the magic of it, right? And so I that's what I try to do every single night. I know it sounds foolish, but I want to give people a knee-wobbling experience every time they come out. I want it to be the best night of the year when they, you know, they come see me do stuff. The other thing I think is I'm so lucky to have a group of fans, supporters, friends, whatever, that come along with me for the ride, you know?
Yeah.
Whether I, like, you know, because I ask a lot of them, don't I? I mean, you know, it's not like, I ask a lot of them, like, oh, guys, guess what? I'm doing a TV show now, and I'd like, you know, oh, well, I'm on a movie. And now, hey, well, guess what? I would like for you all to buy a book. It's a memoir about me, you know? And, like, I am aware that I stretch the bounds.
Just a tad.
Yeah, like, you know, it's not like I don't make it easy on them sometimes, you know, and so when they do show up and it's concert time and it's show time, that's my chance to, you know, to buy it back.
When you walk out on stage, I know that you leave a lot of us and that and the story behind, because it's immediate, it's direct, it's the light, it's the lyrics and the moment. But you're also singing for Petty Harbor.
Yeah. Well, I think, and the book made me realize how kind of proud I am, I think, to be a part of a, I hope a legacy is not too bad of a word, but it's a little bit of a, I think it's a bit of a legacy to Doyle's and Petty Harbor, you know, and I feel like I'm a part of a, you know, a continuum. I'm just one little bit of it, you know, and I get that fuels me in a way that I enjoy, you know, because it makes what is already meaningful in the moment meaningful long after it's over, you know, like that it goes on, you know.
When those people see you and you walk out, do you think they're going to know now why they liked you so much? And perhaps it's because, you know, when you were growing up on Skinner's Hill, there was no heat, there was no food to speak of, there was bread, God bless your mom, there was no toilet, there was no beds, there was no cupboard, there was no none of that stuff, and yet you were happy, safe, and warm.
Yeah. What else is
happy,
there?
Happy, safe, and warm.
Yeah. I think that that whole deal, I mean, I find my young life to be fascinating because, not because I was poor and I made it out of that, but because it never dawned on me for 3 seconds that I might have been poor or had less than anyone else. I was too busy having a laugh. You know, it's like, and my parents, God love them, like I say, were experts at turning hard times into good times. You know, I'm so glad I got it in the book. Like, I think the sentence goes, you know, and occasionally we ran out of oil in the middle of winter, which of course was cause for great celebration. And that's what it was like in my house.
Because you had a ran out of oil party.
Hey, geez, you have an out of oil party. Fantastic. It's like the whole notion of the Irish wake. Someone's dead. Well, put her up. Let's go. It's what else do you do? You know, we do hard times very well, I think.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations on the album. Even though I'm only 5 tracks in, it's a goodie.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
And we'll see you on the tour.
Cheers.
The book is Alan Doyle, Where I Belong, Small Town to Great Big Sea. And the album...
So Let's Go.
And the album's called So Let's Go. And the tour is going to be the So Let's Go tour for January of 2015. It's a great way to kick. And by the way, the book is just in time for Christmas. This is Mulligan's 2 CKUA. By the way, let me ask you a couple of wine questions. Tasting Room Radio. How's your wine habit these days?
Growing, sadly.
Did you anybody teach in all those time, all that time that you spent with Russell Crowe, who's a wine guy?
He is, yeah.
Did he school you on wine?
Well, I can tell you a wine story about it. We were in New York City shooting a movie called Cinderella Man. Sorry, not Cinderella Man. Winter's Tale. Year before, and myself, and Scott Grimes, and a few people. We're in this big sort of housey kind of suite that Russell had in Lower Manhattan. And we didn't have to work the next day, but he did. So at a certain, somewhat respectable time, he went up to bed and he said, you guys just close the doors when you're going or whatever. So me and Scott, we said, we're going to have one more drink or whatever. So we just grabbed a bottle of wine that was on the thing. We opened it up and I think we had a glass of it. And then, you know, I think we drank the rest of it walking up to our hotel out of the bottle or whatever. And it's great, you know, all good. A couple of nights later, we finished shooting, and he said, come back, let's go back to the apartment or whatever, and we'll get steaks and we'll have things. So we, Scott, Russell, a bunch, and he said, oh, I got a good wine for this. I got the, you know, the Louis Chamblon or whatever. And I was like, and he's like, he goes over amongst this table of wine and stuff, says, you guys see that Louis Chamblon? And I was like, and he could tell right away by the look on my face, I was like, he's like, I said, that have a yellowy, sort of a king fella on it? Yeah, where is it? And he goes, did you drink the Louis? He's like, yeah, I'll get you another one. He's like, no, you won't. And I was like, I'll buy you one like it. No, you won't. No, you won't. That was given to me by the movie for the, you know, the billionth dollar value of Gladiator or something like that. It was some significant bottle of hooch that me and Scott Grimes necked walking through Tribeca at 4:30 in the morning. Look, 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 look.
Nice. And that's why we love our wine.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.